from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's been decades since meditation moved out of the ashrams of India and the monasteries of Tibet. It's now in the American mainstream and easier than ever to access. There's an app for that. Of course there is. Dozens, in fact. You can meditate on the subway, on your couch, at the office. Tech leaders, retail giants, and automakers are all integrating the practice into their corporate culture. This hour On Point, making meditation and mindfulness part of your life and routine. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you meditate regularly? Does it enrich your life? How? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. There are all kinds of apps out there these days. Here's a session from one popular app. It's called Calm. Head of content there, meditation instructor Tamara Levitt narrates a 10-minute meditation and relaxation exercise for the app's users. Here she begins.
Let's start today's session by finding a comfortable position with a tall, straight back. Allow your arms to rest gently. When you're ready, close your eyes. Bring full attention to this very moment.
Back straight, birds singing, and it seems pretty great. Is it always easy to get to that very calm place you want to go? Not necessarily. Late last year, CNN's chief medical correspondent, neurosurgeon Dr. Sanjay Gupta, visited the Dalai Lama at his home and meditated with the Buddhist leader. They talked about it. The Dalai Lama said he still struggles with meditation, even though he's been practicing for decades.
People who try to be mindful, who try to meditate, but say that they have difficulty doing it.
Yes, no question, difficulties.
What would you tell them?
Me too.
You too?
Nothing easy.
Even the Dalai Lama can sometimes have difficulties with his meditation. Take that on board. With me now from New York is David Gelis. He writes the New York Times Meditation for Real Life column and reports for the newspaper's Meditation Journeys Immersive Virtual Reality Project. We'll talk about that. He's author of Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out. David Gelis, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
You're a meditator. Have you meditated yet today, sir?
I have not. I woke up and spent some time with my two toddlers, which is a different form of meditation,
yes.
I'd say.
I don't know if it's Zen or not. Describe for us, David, just how mainstream mindfulness and meditation have become in this country.
Mindfulness and meditation, one mark of their just how mainstream they are is that the New York Times has a column about it. You mentioned it, but it's easy for me to kind of take for granted because I've been here as we've kind of slowly over the last couple of years embraced this. But it signals something. It says that this is now enough a part of the mainstream firmament that we're dedicating a weekly spot online and in the paper to it. And that's because it's showing up in sports team with everyone from the Seattle Seahawks to the Boston Red Sox practicing meditation in the locker room. It's showing up in corporate America with Google, Ford, Goldman Sachs, and more teaching executives and mid-level workers and even factory workers to meditate on the job. And it's showing up in professions as diverse as the legal profession, the medical profession, and even the military. It's slowly found a home in just about every professional environment in the country these days.
Why do you think meditation and mindfulness have gained this kind of traction in this country in the last few decades and really become much more widely popular recently?
I think there's three main reasons, and you mentioned it in the intro. This has been a few decades now since it's come, as you said, out of the ashrams of India. But along the way, it's sort of been percolating in the background. Thanks to yoga's rise and kind of dominance of the yoga scene, we're seeing it essentially now fully mainstreamed. I think it's less controversial to think than it was a few decades ago that meditation, maybe there's something to it. We've been hearing about it for a long time now. It's kind of been hanging around. At the same time, over the last couple decades in particular, mindfulness in particular has a lot of scientific work around it. So we now have studies. We have the empirical evidence that shows that this isn't just psychosomatic. This isn't just a placebo. Something's actually happening in our brains and our bodies when we practice mindfulness, when we come back to the present moment over and over again. And finally, I'd say we need it now more than ever. We are habitually distracted. It doesn't matter what job you have, you are probably stressed at some level. And so the opportunity to come back to the present moment and find some modicum of relief from our stress is perhaps more important today than ever before.
Yoga has become very popular in this country. Is that a major carrier of the sort of mindfulness parade?
I think it's helped kind of pave the way for a cultural acceptance of traditions that might have seemed esoteric just a short while ago. And yet a lot of the yoga that you'll find out there today probably has very little to do with what you might find on a meditation app or in a meditation studio. Yoga has become, you know, purely athletic in some of its forms, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I think one of the things we're dealing with in the mindfulness community now is what happens as mindfulness gets so popular that we see it being used for performance enhancement, for the improvement of focus, for example. We're starting to see glimmers of the same debate happen in the mindfulness community. What happens when it gets detached from its so-called spiritual origins and used for more kind of practical utilitarian purposes? And that's an open question that people are wrestling with right now.
Take us into, for people who don't live in this realm, you've got meditation, you've got mindfulness. They are connected, and yet there's not exactly the same thing. One maybe produces the other. Just define terms here.
Absolutely. It's an important exercise, even if we can't be as specific as we might like to. Here's the way I like to come at it. Meditation comes in many flavors and many varieties. And in all religious traditions around the world, really, you'll see something, some form of meditation, some kind of meditation. There's Christian meditation. There's Jewish meditation. There's Hindu meditation. There's Buddhist meditation. The list goes on. Mindfulness is both a synonym, really, for a particular form of largely Southeast Asian Buddhist meditation. Mindfulness meditation is simply the exercise of coming back to the present moment over and over and over again. And the actual term mindfulness is sprinkled across the original Buddhist texts like stars. You see it all over the place. As it's become popularized today, mindfulness is often defined as paying attention in the present moment in a particular way, and not judgmentally. And it's important to note that mindfulness isn't defined as meditating, and yet meditation, the actual practice of that, is the way that we are most easily to achieve that state of mindfulness. So I like to say mindfulness is kind of a quality of being, and meditation is the practice that helps us achieve that state of being.
What's the breakdown in how Americans are coming to meditation? And of course, as you say, there are many kinds here. I think when we say it, people often think of, associate it with the kind of meditation that's come out of India. Of course, Christianity talks about meditation and prayer, many other religions as well. But if it's sort of the classic, what we think of as meditation these days, how do people come to it? Are apps playing a big role in that? I'm seeing a lot of apps out there, Buddhify and Calm and Headspace and Om Vana and a bunch of others. What are the avenues that take people to meditation these days?
Apps are certainly playing a big role, but the truth is that there's a large on-the-ground network of retreat centers, of drop-in meditation studios, and we're now seeing, just like you have yoga studios where you can pop in for your 45-minute session at lunchtime, we have these now in New York and Los Angeles and in other cities. Drop-in meditation studios where you can pay your $15 and come in for a short, you know, pick-me-up or meditation session on your way home from work. It's pretty remarkable that we've come so far, so fast. Besides that, there's a whole other kind of camp of meditation, which is transcendental meditation. It's not what I'm most familiar with. It's not what we're writing about as much in the New York Times. But TM, transcendental meditation, is enjoying a big renaissance at the same time as the mindfulness boom is happening. And so those are the two big camps, I think, that most Americans are getting exposed to meditation through. Mindfulness on the one hand, TM on the other. And they work hand in hand. They're not exactly rivals, you could say.
People are paying attention. We've got calls coming in for you, David. Robert in Miami, thank you for calling. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I don't have too many questions right now. I just think that Zen Buddhism is a great thing. Breathing is very important. You'll tap into spirituality if you do it. I did want to make a point. In this day and age, we're so connected to the internet that we lose this sort of sense of spirituality. We spend time on the internet communicating through through Facebook versus sitting next to each other and meditating using telepathy, if you believe in that. There's ways to sort of fire synapses through meditation. I think people should be more open to it. And my last point is that you can do it anywhere. You don't have to do it, you know, like, oh, $15 to go to this place. I think I can sit down right now and just do it and close my eyes and begin to breathe, because that's basically it. So, well, that's my point.
Robert, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. David, are apps, what are these apps like? Are they contradictory to the whole idea of mindfulness and meditation? You've got your cell phone in your hand, or is it just like having a teacher next to you? What do they do?
There's some deep irony here, right? The web, smartphones, Facebook, social media, these are perhaps some of the greatest sources of our distraction these days. And so we're going to turn to yet another app on our smartphone to alleviate that stress and that level of distraction. The irony is rich, and yet, I would say if the teachings are authentic, if the purpose of the exercises that you're doing on your smartphone or you're listening to through your podcast are actually helping you come back to the present moment, if you're not just playing a game on a meditation app, but actually coming back to the present moment, feeling your body, taking note of your emotions and the physical sensations in your body, then really the medium doesn't matter so much. I don't care if it's coming through a smartphone speaker or from a teacher in a meditation hall in the woods. If the actual practice is the same, then I think there's probably a lot of benefit to it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about meditation and mindfulness exploding in the mainstream, becoming, in a way, part of the American way these days. You can join us this hour. Do you practice mindfulness, meditation? Why and how? What do you get from it? What do you need from it? Where do you meditate? When? At the office, at home, on the subway, with an app? Are we doing it because we're all so stressed now? Is it a real fix? Is it a Band-Aid on the stress? Is it just a way to be? In 2014, the UN General Assembly, no less, it's a little bit different thing, but it's related, adopted a resolution proclaiming June 21st as International Day of Yoga. The following year, hundreds on that day gathered in a park in Atlanta to chant and meditate. Home there in Atlanta. And of course, yoga is a little different, but the end of many yoga sessions can be very athletic, as my guest David Geller says. But many end with this savasana, sort of lying on your back, very calm, palms up, relaxed pose. Here's a couple of yoga instructors, Tracy and Margaret Stockelper, talking about this savasana meditative end to a yoga session.
Great for stress relief as well. The idea to create stillness not only through the physical body, but also through the mental body, so letting go of any thoughts, any distractions, and just finding a few moments of your day just to find some stillness, some relaxation.
Of course, it can be kind of utilitarian as well, as my guest David Gelis from the New York Times says. This is on Bloomberg Television, Google's chief evangelist of brand marketing. This is Gopi Khalil, describing how the tech giant Google uses yoga and meditation to increase productivity.
For the 7 billion human beings on the planet, the most important technology we work with, every single person, is right here. Our body, our breath, our consciousness, our brain. Everything we experience in our life, whether it is this conversation, a piece of food we eat, or a music we listen, has to be processed by this technology. And these traditions like yoga and meditation help us, what I call, optimize this technology in order to allow each of us to live better.
Optimizing this technology, that is your body. David Geller writes the Meditation for Real Life column for the New York Times. He's author of Mindful Work, How Meditation is Changing Business from the Inside Out, and joins us from New York. With me in the studio right now is Sarah Lazar. She's a neuroscientist and researcher in psychiatry at the Massachusetts General Hospital, PhD in microbiology and molecular genetics, paying a lot of attention to neural mechanisms here. Sarah Lazar, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
David Gelis tells us that it's not just cultural, it's scientific. How does meditation work if it's really working in some way that's physical?
Right. Yes. As he mentioned, it actually has an impact on our brain. So our research and the research of many other people show that when you meditate, there's very specific brain regions which get turned on and others get turned off. So the part of the brain that's involved in mind wandering gets turned off when you meditate, and other parts of the brain that are involved in attention and focus get turned on. And if you practice regularly, you actually get changes in the structure of your brain. And so our data showed that even after 8 weeks of practice, we could show very reliable changes in the hippocampus and the several other brain regions that are important for attention and emotion regulation.
Can you explain how that works? If I straighten my back and I breathe deeply and calmly and I focus the mind, how does that actually produce a change in my brain? What's the causal mechanism here?
Right. So the idea is that, you know, because you start paying attention to your breath or your thoughts mm-hmm. in your body, and of course the mind starts to wander. And so you have to be aware that it's wandering and then bring your attention back. And so we liken it to, it's a form of attention training. So just as if you exercise your muscles, those get bigger. If you exercise your brain in a particular way, those neural circuits are going to get stronger.
Mm-hmm. And so over time, is there a cumulative effect? I mean, we heard even the Dalai Lama saying after all his decades of meditating, it's not always easy.
Yeah, no, definitely. We definitely see that over time, more and more changes happen and the changes become stronger and stronger.
If this is more widely adopted, I don't know, can you compare countries where this is more or less popular and see, you know, at the level of public health, can you see differences?
I don't know that anyone's done that exactly. But certainly there's numerous studies that show that meditation and yoga certainly improve health and wellness. Certainly here, you know, most stress reduction clinics are based on meditation. And there's been, you know, thousands of studies showing mm-hmm. that there's a decrease in symptoms when you start these practices.
Sarah Lazar, David Gelis, standby. Lots of callers for the two of you. Aaron's calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. My comment's really brief here. I work at a transitional housing center here in Tampa, and my job is mainly with the youth in the program that are kind of staying over. They're homeless and at-risk kids, and lately we've started a mindfulness and meditation course, and I just wanted to comment that since the inception of the program to where we are now, I've seen tremendous leaps and bounds in how some of these kids who, you know, sometimes could come from very, you know, traumatic situations, how they are able to identify, you know, their emotions and identify what's kind of picking up or causing these things after a couple of sessions of work and mindfulness and, you know, meditation. They're able to kind of put a finger on what's causing them to have these kinds of emotions. And it's been really, really helpful in getting these teens to kind of cope with the situation here.
So just a few weeks of this for the teens in your homeless shelter or transitional shelter, and you see impact. Aaron, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Jim in Burlington, Vermont. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I took a 10-week course with a psychiatrist, and I was surprised to learn how much physical change just a thought can create, you know, catastrophizing.
Jim, what kind of course did you take, Jim? Forgive me, but what kind of course?
It was actually on anxiety. I was, diagnosed with anxiety, and insurance paid for it. It was at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And went on for 10 weeks, all Saturday morning. And we practiced all kinds of things. We learned a lot about how emotion or thoughts create emotion, which then create the physical adrenaline surges through your body. And then, of course, the practice of in mindfulness of actually dropping into the breath. That is focusing on just breathing. And I can tell you that I'm almost 73 years old, and I had done TM before, but this was mind opening to me. And where I use it most is when I can feel my body reacting, becoming emotional. Mm-hmm. And a good example would be what could lead to road rage. And when I feel that somebody's cutting me off and I want to, you know, give them the finger or something,
yeah.
I can actually breathe. Look, think about my nose, take a breath or two or three, and it actually calms me back down. And, you know, I let the guy go on.
Jim, you're telling me people get road rage in bucolic Vermont?
Well, once in a while, I drive to Boston.
Oh, okay. Then it's guaranteed. Jim, I really appreciate your call. David Gellis there, you see, you know, north and south, people grabbing onto this. I mean, Jim's 73, and, you know, he's got a lot of life experience, but even at that age, it's making a difference to him.
Well, I think one of the things that Jim maybe helped us remember is that the nature of the mind doesn't change from New York City to Burlington, Vermont to Boston. We're all dealing with the same personal neuroses, with the same stresses. You know, they might manifest a little differently, but we're all just trying to get through the day, and we all have to deal with these sources of agitation. And that's why mindfulness has proven to be this universal technique that can be helpful to people across the board, and for kids in particular, from the previous caller. Mindfulness is showing up in schools, and you talk to teachers who bring mindfulness into previously rambunctious, disruptive classrooms, and after a few weeks, even a few sessions sometimes, these kids who just learned to start paying attention to the physical sensations of their body and get out of this hamster wheel of their mind and come back to the present moment, it can make all the difference in those classrooms.
So, I mean, your headlines made me laugh. You've got how to be mindful at the gym, how to be mindful with your phone, how to be mindful if your flight is delayed. What?
Yeah.
Take us through those. What do you mean mindful at the gym?
So you're referring to this column that we launched late last year called Meditation for Real Life in the Well section of the New York Times. And I have to give Well's editor, Tara Parker Pope, a lot of credit. She really helped shape this and create this vision. And you mentioned that I kind of write it, but that's not even the right verb. I kind of curate this.
Okay.
So Meditation for Real Life is a column where once a week on Wednesday morning, every week, we put up a new brief meditation, if you will, how to have a mindful New Year, how to be mindful with your in-laws, how to be mindful at the desk.
But explain what these things mean, how to be mindful.
Well, exactly. The idea, and it's a simple but potent one, and it's something one of our first callers actually mentioned. You don't have to go into a meditation studio and pay $15. Being mindful is something you can do absolutely anywhere, no matter what activity you're doing. And what we're trying to do with this column is remind readers, sometimes in a kind of whimsical, playful way, that you can access mindfulness. You can come back to the present moment wherever you are.
But the present moment can be very frustrating when your flight is delayed.
Well, absolutely. And no one said that mindfulness was an innately pleasant activity. And I'd love to hear Sarah's thoughts on this, because I know she has a lot of experience of actual practice. But mindfulness isn't about distracting ourselves from whatever might be bugging us and going to some pleasant, you know, kind of euphoric state. It's about being very real with what's happening in our brains, our bodies, and with our emotions. And sometimes that means confronting some unpleasant states.
Sarah, how about it? The path to something better at that moment where your flight is delayed. You get the news, you're standing there, you know, you got 16 people waiting for you and you're not going to arrive in time, or that moment of road rage that our caller describes. How does one access mindfulness at that moment? What's the impact of that access?
It's really pretty amazing. So often when you have those moments of frustration and anger or whatever, there's a lot of thoughts. And so to be mindful just means stop the thoughts and just check in with your body. And just actually feel the anger for one moment, even for just the briefest of moments.
Okay.
And then also...
But I want to get on the plane.
Yeah. But often also looking at the motivations behind it and the thoughts, and often just stepping back for a moment, you sort of see that it's ridiculous. You know, I can be here and angry about the fact that I'm going to miss my plane, but I can also realize, okay, there's nothing I can do about it. And often just taking that moment and having that moment of pause, you sort of allows you to sort of disengage from the frustration of the moment and sort of see the bigger picture and realize, okay, getting angry is not going to help me here.
And the body responds to that disengagement from the anger?
Definitely, yeah. It's like a circuit breaker is, I think, the best way to explain it. And so and often you see the silly habits of your mind and your thought patterns, and you realize, oh. And so the analogy I like to say is, you know, sometimes you'll see someone – you know, doing something stupid or thoughtless or having a fit, and you're just like, can't they see that this isn't a, you know, good response? And they don't see because they're lost in their head. And when you're mindful, it allows you to sort of step outside and see yourself. And then you say, oh, you know, you do see yourself. Like, you see it. And so then you just realize, oh, this is not a smart thing to do.
Anna is calling from Southwest Ranches, Florida. Anna, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for taking my call. I agree so much with what's been said so far. Share my experience. Should that help someone else get started in some way? I've been meditating for about, like so many people, on and off for years, but in earnest for only about 3 years. And what it's done for me is help me not dwell in the past, not fret about the future, and just be in the moment, being the best I can be, to be available to who is directly in front of me, to myself. And certainly the more you do it, the more you get out of it, like anything else. And as other callers and guests have said, it's not necessarily pleasant. But the best that I can describe is it just helps you understand for you individually where you are and what matters and how you can be a force for good in the world instead of being overwhelmed by the world. And as far as tangible benefits, again, personal to me, with a neurology disorder I have cut my pain meds in half after 10 years. With orthopedic problems I have, I am off the pain medicine. And it's not that the pain went away. It's that I'm able to better cope and have it not cause restless nights and distractions. And so it's there, but I live with it. My relationship with my son, we had a good relationship already, I'm happy to say. He's only 15. He's so grateful at how I listen now, how I listen to him, how I really hear him. So to everybody out there, there's so many options. You know, try something. If it works for you, wonderful. If it doesn't, try something else.
Hey, Anna, you sound pretty committed. How much time do you spend doing this, Anna?
What I try to do, now that I know how to do it, I needed a lot of support at the beginning because it can be hard to keep that position, and it can be hard to let all your thoughts come rushing in the silence. So in the beginning, I did it more in a group setting, and now what I do is every morning, just for 5 or 10 minutes, and then to keep sort of the power of the group going, there's 3 sessions a week that I'll try to make it to at least one. And then we sometimes have longer weekend retreats like we have coming up next week, which is a silent retreat from Thursday night to Sunday morning. And, you know, that's it.
A couple of days of silence. Radio talk show hosts don't know how to do that, at least not when they're working. But I'm glad that you're doing it, Anna. And I can kind of, I don't know. I feel, Sarah, that I can hear in Anna's voice the kind of product of that work. Maybe I'm wrong.
Definitely, yeah. No, and silent retreats, I've been on a couple. And yeah, the first time I was just like, there's no way I can do this. But it's actually, they're very, very powerful. You really see your mind in a way that you never would think that you could.
Is there any culture clash with American culture here, David?
There's even a term for what you're getting at, this tension between a real robust and genuine interest in the meditative tradition and the inevitable efforts by the American culture and corporations to commodify it and to profit off it. And that term is McMindfulness. So just like we have McMansions, we've got McMindfulness now. The kind of precise line of attack is that mindfulness and meditation are these noble traditions which ultimately are about relieving suffering and kind of getting off the karmic wheel at the end of the day, according to the Buddha. And yet here we have people espousing mindfulness courses and selling mindfulness apps, all it seems with the emphasis on making a buck.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about meditation and mindfulness exploding in the mainstream, becoming part of the American way lately. Is this your way? Are you a meditator? How does it impact your life? Sarah Lazar is with us. She's a neuroscientist and researcher at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Has looked closely at how this all works inside our brains. David Gallis is here from the New York Times. He writes the Meditation for Real Life column there. You can join us as well. Lots of response online here. People talking about this being commodified. Matt says, as a Buddhist, I'm all for the commodification of meditation. Sure, it's shallow, but it's also a foot in the door to other ways of thinking about the world, which I think eventually will be a good thing. You can count on me, writes on our website, to achieve deep mindfulness, you have to refine your diet and remove addictive elements from it. Turn off the apps, television, internet, and radio, and connect with nature. Okay, we'll ask about that with somebody who's made an app for meditation mindfulness. It doesn't always work out so great. Jimmy Kimmel had a little fun with it last fall. Last September, he took his Aunt Chippy to a meditation class with some other family members and friends with not the best results.
Breathing in and out of the nose and with ass. We should probably put the cell phone.
I have a lot of money on the San Francisco Giants.
We're actually not allowed to have them in here.
I'm going to try this. I'm going to really try this.
Yeah. We had almost 4 seconds of silence there. I think that was a record. That was good.
Coughing cell phone didn't really work out. But if you want to get focused on this zone, there are a lot of apps out there now. Here's one. Lynn Goldberg's app is OMG, I Can Meditate. Meditation coach leads users through 5 minutes of deep breathing and relaxation set to soft, soothing music.
With each in-breath, your body is filled with vitalizing white light. On each out-breath, let it's melting into the comfort and support of your position. Your whole body fully melted into relaxation.
All right. Sarah Lazar, David Gallis, stand by. We have the woman behind that relaxing voice with us right now from Montreal. Lynn Goldberg joins us. She's founder of the app OMG, I Can Meditate! Exclamation mark. Lynn, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
How's it work? The app, is it just, it's you on my phone, and I just put the earbuds in and close my eyes on the subway, and you take me there?
Yeah, we actually developed it with the intention of starting you off first thing in the morning. So we wake you up with an alarm, and we start your day with intention or with gratitude, and it's just a quick couple of minutes just to get you started. And then we have an actual 12-week program that takes you through from A to Z all the basics of meditation. So we just, you know, sitting postures and focusing on your breath to stepping back and all the different basics of meditation. And then one of the things that you just heard was just a check-in so that you can, if you find yourself getting anxious during the day, you can take a couple minutes. Or we have something that deals with, like, my boss is a jerk, for example, which is really for people that are having a hard time with compassion. So just any type of situation that could come up that you would have to deal with during the course of your day, we have something for that, too.
And then do you keep tabs on me? If I'm not meditating enough, you start pinging me or sending me angry texts?
We do. You know, we really want people to be successful. And what's really important for us is that technology is such a fabulous tool to help people develop meditation practice. And if we can help get people started, then why not?
So this is kind of a substitute for going to a class or sitting with a guru.
One of the biggest obstacles to getting a meditation practice started is usually time. People often say, you know, it's not for me or I don't have time. And this is a way to get people to find the time. because anyone can say, you know, we start people at 10 minutes, we have a little bit of music because most people are terrified of being alone with their thoughts. And then we slowly increase the time, we take away the music, and we develop an actual practice. It's done very, very deliberately so that people break. It's like walking into a pool. We get the water. We mm-hmm. make it very warm initially.
if I go like all the way to the top of your game there on this app, how long will I be meditating? Like where do you max out?
Well, we stop. We allow people to choose their duration anytime they'd like. So okay. I think it's 40, 45 minutes, something
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot. We've got questions for all of you. Priya in Boston. Priya, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. My question is for Dr. Lazar. I actually have two, if I may.
Yeah.
And my question stems from a discussion I've had with my boyfriend. It's an ongoing discussion about the definition of meditation and the benefits he may reap. And he claims that his form of meditation is cardiovascular exercise, specifically long-distance running. And when he does do that, he does focus on his breath. He does focus on where he is in the moment.
Yep.
Whereas I'm more of a traditionalist and practice by assuming the traditional position of seated upright, back straight,
yep.
focusing on the breath and doing some abdominal breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is for Dr. Lazar, if benefits can be reaped in both fashions, and if that's been studied and if that can actually have a physiologic impact on the hippocampus that she mentioned earlier.
Priya, hold that thought first. Let's go right to it. Dr. Lazar, we've got some relationship counseling for you to do here. do both count? If he runs in a meditative fashion, is it the same as sitting and meditating?
So basically yoga and Tai Chi and whatnot are be similar to that. And so if it's really being done in a truly mindful way, then it would be similar to yoga or Tai Chi. We and others have shown that there are differences between yoga and sitting meditation. They're subtle, but there are some differences. So and the other question is he really doing it mindful? Because it's not just paying attention to the breath. It's also paying attention to what's going on in the mind as well. And there's, again, the non-judgmental part of it. It's mm-hmm. It's a particular way of paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be mindful. It may not be. I would have to talk to him to know for sure. But in theory, it could be if he's doing it the right way.
David, are you buying that? Marathoners are meditating?
My wife is the runner, and I'm the sitter in our family. And we have a similar debate, and I kind of hold my ground here. The practice of mindfulness, as it's commonly taught and you know, probably even on the app, is really not so much just about being embodied and feeling the sensations of our body. It's getting to know the nature of our mind. And while physical exercise, yoga and running, cardiovascular activity can give us that flow state experience and really in a way kind of turn thought off and make us very embodied,
mm-hmm.
I don't believe that over time it gives us the same kind of intimacy with our thought processes, with our emotional landscapes that is really a critical element of long-term mindfulness practice. So no, I actually don't think they're the same thing.
Lynn, we're going to toss it to you. I'm sure you'll be happy for whoever buys your app, whether they're running or sitting, but what about it?
I completely agree with David in that sense. We have a whole week that we devote to, you know, what's on your playlist, that idea of really watching your habitual patterns and starting to notice the quality of the thoughts and noticing the typical patterns of behavior that you have. And it's vital. It's the ultimate goal of meditation is to discover who you really are. So unless you can do that while you're running, but I tend to think it's the quieter you are, the more still you are, the more you can come to that realization.
Priya, it sounds as though the debate may go on in your relationship given those three answers. You got a second question, Priya?
I do. I actually work in obesity management. I'm a physician myself.
Okay.
And I'm really interested in helping my patients establish a routine of practicing mindfulness as they work with their appetite and noticing the hunger sensation and what to do with that and how frequently it occurs during the day. So again, the question is for all, what is the data about that, and in which direction are we going when it comes to obesity management or weight management and mindfulness package.
That is interesting. Sarah Lazar, does that sound promising to you?
Yes, there's actually been several programs that have been developed specifically incorporating mindfulness for diet change. And it seems to be very effective for helping people make more wise choices about what they eat. They start becoming aware of, you know, when they eat junk food, how that makes them feel, when they eat veggies, how that makes them feel. There's a lot of promising research on that.
Priya, thanks so much for your call and good luck to you in your work. Heidi in Baltimore. Heidi, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. So I'm a psychotherapist, and I did a dissertation on the effects of nature on psychological well-being. And I believe in mindfulness, and I was trying to figure out how to combine the two of them. In addition to that, many clients that come in say, you know what, this mindfulness thing, it's just not for me. I just can't sit still and I can't do this. But what I found is when I do take them into nature settings, into the park, or I've developed a program where I really do take people out for the weekend into nature or to the park, that mindfulness tends to come very naturally because they tune into the sounds and the smells and the way that they feel the rocks and the earth under their feet. And so after that experience, they realize that they can really actually do mindfulness. So it's a different introduction, but I think a very natural introduction because, you know, from evolution and things like that, I feel like, you know, we come from nature. It's our home in some way. So when we do this homecoming and we go into nature and all of a sudden all these things drop away, it's such a natural way of introducing mindfulness.
But Heidi, you're the psychotherapist. You take them for a walk in the park and you think they arrive there, or is that a prelude to sitting down and meditating and they're more capable of going there after getting in touch with nature?
Yeah, so I think that actually that it's not so much a prelude. It's a little bit like the other caller that was saying they're running, right? So if the goal is to have them anchor in the present moment or come back to the present moment. Mm-hmm. So what I do, for example, I pick a section of a trail that I know is not, you know, too use too much, and I say to them, we're going to walk for 10 minutes, and what I want you to do is really be present to all the sounds and smells and things that you feel underneath your feet. And I say, what's going to happen is your mind is going to go to different things, what's for dinner or what I need to get done, and then just bring it back as soon as you realize that you're doing this exercise and that there's the sound of a cricket, and then you tune back into the present moment, and that weaving in and out of present moment and going and coming back, that's mindfulness.
Hey, Heidi, I appreciate your call. David Gelles, I have a feeling you're not going to go there again. You studied meditation all over. Is a walk in the park get you where you need to go?
Not in and of itself, but here I'll meter halfway. Nature is one of the most conducive places to practice mindfulness, and it's easy to understand why. In nature, if we put away our phones, we're free from so many of the distractions that can feed this, you know, endless cycle of rumination, of fantasizing about the future and worrying about the past, of distracting ourselves with fantasies about how we might like our lives to be. You know, away from screens, away from billboards, away from Times Square, where I'm sitting right now, it's much easier to come back to the present moment and to notice not only the sensations in our own minds and bodies, but also the natural world around us. And that's all part of mindfulness. You know, when Thoreau went to Walden Pond, he didn't use the word mindfulness in that book. But if you read what he was doing, he talks about coming back to the stillness of the moment. And he comes back, and I'm not quoting him exactly here, but he talks about really being in the present moment and getting away from this endless cycle of thought that he could sense himself caught up in, which is to say that mindfulness, this is a universal quality. This isn't something culturally specific. It's something that all of us have access to and something that so many of us, I think, innately long for.
So many callers. Miami, Eli, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yes.
I'm a mindfulness trained facilitator at UCLA, and when I facilitate my sessions or my workshops, I use different gateways for people to experience mindfulness, and that the fact of being present, it can be sounds, taste, even conversation. I do a lot of relational mindfulness where people can listen and talk mindfully, and then there's a full experience, which is not on their heads, but it's on the full body. I heard many of the callers and your guests talking about how we embody this practice, which means feeling really what's going on. It's not just a thought about the conversation. It's also what I'm feeling at the moment, how much attention I'm paying to myself. So I can tell you it's a very effective way to regulate emotions and even open up for new things to come.
And is it practically useful in the world, Eli? I mean, it sounds like a good thing on its face, but does it have an impact on the way you see people living around you?
Absolutely. I work mostly with the Hispanic community. I do my workshops in Spanish. A lot of people are here starting a new life. It's a new city, a new culture, a new country. And mindfulness helps you to be present for that transition, to be aware of all your options, and also being able to tap on your resources. Because at the end, mindfulness helps us to understand our lives, our minds, and if we are more prepared to respond instead of just react, we're more able to act on a conscious and intentional way. And that's what mindfulness helps us with.
Eli, I really appreciate your call from Miami. Lynn Goldberg, we're all getting very elevated here. do you see something that amounts to a cultural change afoot?
Yeah, I think there's a real wave of people really desiring more mindfulness in their lives. And I think it's part and parcel because of technology. On the one hand, you have so many distractions in our day-to-day lives that it's inherent in our being to want to have some time in.
A time in, i.e. in the present, here.
Yeah, checking in with yourself, checking in, being mindful, really.
Sarah, do you see people having pretty good success? Or, you know, what's the drop-off rate? People say, I want to do this, and then don't?
Right. Well, in our studies, typically about 10 to 15% of people drop out. Mm-hmm. But most people stick with it, and they actually practice. We actually have people record how much they're practicing, and they do it. We tell them to practice 40 minutes a day, and they actually do it. And, you know, I'm always amazed by the stories I hear at the end. You know, people just saying, it completely changed my life.
Hey, talk about New America. Maybe it's arriving a little bit. Sarah Lazar, researcher at Massachusetts General Hospital, thank you so much for joining us today. Lynn Goldberg, founder of the app OMG, I Can Meditate. Lynn, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And David Gellis with the Meditation for Real Life column at the New York Times. David on Times Square, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.